was the Famous Music Corporation, 1619 Broadway, New York City, back in what, 1942, 43? And I can just picture it now, a bunch of Jews sitting around a studio there in New York City, all safe and sound, singing that song, Praise the Lord and Pass the Ammunition. Probably they couldn't hardly stand it from breaking out laughing. Yeah, somebody made a lot of money on that song, and they weren't, well, let's say this, I'll bet you $50 they were all Jews. When they call us Goyim, or our race Goyim, they're right on track about that, a bunch of sheep. You can talk into about anything. Hey, it's September the 22nd. 2017, and this is Freya's Day, Ladies' Day in the Bunker. Words and music to that song were written by, and the music by Frank Loesser, L-O-E-S-S-E-R. Guess what? Ha! Let's have another one there for World War II, the war to make the world safe for Jews and traitor profiteers.
Gory, gory, what a hell of a way to die. Gory, gory, what a hell of a way to die. Gory, gory, what a hell of a way to die. And he ain't gonna jump no more. Is everybody happy? Cries the shaker looking up. A hero meekly answered yes, and then they stood him up. He leaped right out into the blast, his static line and hook. And he ain't gonna jump no more. Glory, glory, what a hell of a way to die. Glory, glory, what a hell of a way to die. Glory, glory, what a hell of a way to die. And he ain't gonna jump no more.
He counted loud, he counted long, he waited for the shot. He felt the wind, he felt the clouds, he felt the awful drop. He took his reserve, the silk spilled out and wrapped around his legs.
And he ain't gonna jump no more.
His risers wrapped around his neck, connectors cracked his dome. His lines were tied and stalled in knots around his skinny bone. His canopy became his shroud, he hurtled to the ground.
And he ain't gonna jump no more. Glory, glory, what a hell of a way to die. Glory, glory, what a hell of a way to die. Glory, glory, what a hell of a way to die. And he ain't gonna jump no more.
The days he lived and loved and laughed kept running through his mind. He thought about the girl back home, the one he left behind. He thought about the medics and he wondered what they'd find. And he ain't gonna jump no more.
The ambulance was on the spot, but he's been running wild. The medics screamed and jumped with me, rolled up their sleeves and smiled. For it had been a week or more since that the shoot had failed.
And he ain't gonna jump no more.
He hit the ground, the sun was flat, his blood was burning high. His comrades then we heard to say, what a hell of a way to die. He lay there rolling round in all the welter of his gore.
And he ain't gonna jump no more. Glory, glory, what a hell of a way to die. Glory, glory, what a hell of a way to die. Glory, glory, what a hell of a way to die. And he ain't gonna jump no more.
Yeah.
I counted 10,000, waited too long, reached for my ribbon, the head of the
glory, glory, what a hell of a way to die. Glory, glory, what a hell of a way to die. Glory, glory, what a hell of a way to die. And he ain't gonna jump no more.
It shows a bunch of pictures, black and white, along with these songs. Now, number one, all those guys singing, they didn't go anywhere. They were sitting in a cushy studio in New York City or L.A., Hollywood, or someplace. And these pictures now show troops all set for the battle, all huddled into these transport planes, like paratroopers and so forth. And they're taking their picture, black and white, and they're all smiling like a bunch of idiots, not realizing that in a few hours, at least a third, maybe a half of them are going to have their guts laying all over the ground. But that's how the Jews work you, man. Play you. They play you all the time. They play you so easily. And people like the Jews, like the Judeo-Christians. Yeah, we're going to go to fight for the Lord. Ha! Yeah, Goyim, Goyim. And so for the last 16 years or better, we've been fighting for Israel's fight in the Middle East. It's at least two-thirds for Israel and one-third for the capitalistas and their drive for goodies and oil and minerals and all that that they can get out of the ground like Afghanistan. And don't forget the cocaine out of Afghanistan. Yeah. And used to argue, well, we're not goyim. I don't know what other term you could use could be more insulting than we've become goyim for a long time, and the time to be goyim is long over. It's time to, you know what it's time for. There lost people in World War II. Well, this you know, like Frank Sinatra here set in a studio here in L.A. pumping out this kind of music to keep you fighting for Jewish democracy. Wow. Just think of it. How many of you had people who died in World War II or were seriously maimed or lost their legs or arms, blind and all that kind of stuff, fighting for what they call today democracy? And our race will do it again. They'll get another one going. We're not done with this one yet. 16 years of war in the Middle East. Hell, they're not done with this yet, but as soon as this is over, they'll have another one going. So you get all pissed off when they call you goyim and call you sheep, but that's what our race has been for a long time. Long time. I think Friday's a good day to talk about riots, because there'll probably be some over the weekend. Yeah, in Fada and all those people. Everybody likes a riot, man. And I got the Book of Riots in front of me. Riots USA from 1765 to 1965 by Willard A. Heaps. I read to you the other day about the draft riots in New York City. Boy, that was something else. That was a Wyatt riot. Now, let's start with the anatomy of a riot. We're living in climates of violence. A New York Herald Tribune editorial stated that Los Angeles watched riots in August 1965. Turmoil is everywhere, in many countries throughout the world, as well as our own nation. Ever since the end of World War II, a serious discontent has seized the world's people, erupting constantly into protest. Well, it's been going on for a long time. Good old Watts riots. I lived about, maybe 10 miles from where the ground central of the Watts riots. About 10 miles. I know one thing. I was working up in Palos Verdes, just south of California, on this Palos Verdes mountain. And every morning I drove up there to go to work. And I'd look down and I'd see the plumes of smoke coming up from Watts, hundreds and hundreds of feet in the air. Yeah. Yeah, I knew a lot of guys who were in the Minutemen, and they were getting into that situation. There were a lot of guys out there, white guys got into cars and guns and went down there and went Negro hunting. My brother-in-law was a fireman that had to go in there and try to put out fires while they were shooting at him. I used to have an audio of the L.A. police radio during that period, back when you could get police calls on a regular AM radio. And you could hear all that stuff. It's snipers everywhere, snipers all over the place. And the poor firemen are trying to put the fire out, you know. They're being shot. Yeah, the good old Watts riots. Yeah, the Minutemen. I knew this through a guy I knew that was involved. I never was in the Minutemen, but I knew about them and I respected them. Well, anyhow, they met, the Minutemen met with the Black Panthers, or whoever was the most radical blacks of the day, in a warehouse several weeks before the Watts riots. And I said, well, what happened? He said, well, the blacks said, it's going to go. We're going to rise up. And the guy said, well, what's the situation? He said, well, hell, all the money that we work for to get down here, they take and loan it out up in Beverly Hills with the Jews, you know, and we don't own any of the houses. They're all owned by Jew renter landlords and so forth. And we've decided, and so the Minutemen left, and two or three weeks later, the Watts riots erupted, and it erupted over just one thing. It was very hot that night, and a black woman failed to stop properly at a crosswalk, and a cop was citing her, giving her a ticket, and all of a sudden, that's when the riot started. It doesn't take too much to get a riot started, but it takes a hell of a lot to get it stopped. So anyhow, there's a lot of dead bodies ended up in the L.A. River and so forth during that thing, you know. So anyhow, that's some of the stuff I knew about at the time. Social scientists studying the outbreaks have written thousands of words in an attempt to define this contemporary spirit of tension. They agree only that a worldwide social revolution is taking place with explosive manifestations on the streets and cities and towns, on the campuses of colleges and universities, and in front of the American embassies throughout the world, as well as on Pennsylvania Avenue in front of the White House. The key word in the explanations of these violent protests is always dissatisfaction, and it is aggravated dissatisfaction and discontent that foment riots. The nature and the location of the contemporary protests appear to have no limits. For the three spring months, March through May of 1965, for example, the New York Times covered 23 riots in as many foreign countries. American embassies and consulates were targets in 11 of these violent incidents. In Indonesia twice, Soviet Russia, Mexico, Japan, Cambodia, Argentina, Venezuela, Chile, Peru, and Colombia. The anti-American mobs ranged in size from 500 to 25,000, and the majority of the rioters were students who clashed with both the local police and national soldiers, resulting in many injuries and an occasional death. Buildings were stoned, windows smashed, and several embassies set fire. I'll tell you how it worked in the Middle East, because Dr. Stuart Crane, who had been with the John Birch Society for some time, gave a lecture, and it's available on our website. And in that thing, he's talking about how the communists got riots going over in the Middle East. They had a set pattern where the couple of guys would be the leaders, and they'd get up on a perch and give speeches and harangue the people in the street until they get a mob going. And then they'd say, let's go down towards the police station, you know. And so the mob would follow the mob leaders on the way to the police station. And when they got within about a half a block, the leaders would step into a doorway and the mob would surge forward towards the police station, and the police were ready for them with machine guns to mow the mob down. The leaders did not get punished at all, because that's what they were doing, agitating for insurrection or revolution. I don't know whether these Infanta idiots, Bolsheviks, are that smart. They'd probably stay at the head of the column and get machine gun. But the smart way to do that is, like I say, harangue the crowd, get a mob going, say, now let's go towards the police station or the White House or wherever. And they'd march down yelling and screaming and waving flags. And like I say, the people who are running show step off the street into a doorway, and the mob would keep going and get to the station and get mowed down. And then they'd have martyrs for their cause. And that's the way it was. Three of the most serious of the spring 1965 riots were against the reestablishment of diplomatic relations. Arabs in Iraq and Lebanon attacked the local embassies of West Germany in protest against the country's diplomatic recognition of Israel. Well, I don't blame them. For an entire week in April, Korean students clashed repeatedly with police in protest against the renewal of diplomatic relations with Japan, which had occupied Korea from 1910 to 1945. Tunisians attacked the embassy of the United Arab Republic in protest against slighting remarks made about their president. Africans in Kenya rioted for 3 days against the Asians. Teenage high school students by the thousands rioted in Morocco protesting cutbacks in education. French architectural students in Paris destroyed 350 drawings because of the method by which a competition was judged. Separatist French Canadians in Montreal attempted to stop the observance of Victoria Day, a national holiday. This was a period when the United States was relatively free from disturbances resulting from organized protest. Even so, 57 Negroes were injured on March 7 in Selma, Alabama, when state police used tear gas, nightsticks, and whips to disperse a column of 500 demonstrators beginning a freedom walk to Montgomery, the state capital, to protest voter registration procedures. It's always amused me of how hard a lot of blacks fought for the vote when the vote doesn't mean a shit anyhow. They were dying in the streets for fixed voting, fixed votes. Accounts of current riotous protests invariably include common elements, crowds or mobs, slogans shouted and chanted or written on placards and signs, violent physical actions such as throwing objects, smashing windows, and attacking cars and persons, and the resistance to the agents of law enforcement, whether police or soldiers. Dictionaries generally list three meanings of the word riot when used as a noun. The first definition, in its simplest form, is a mass outburst against law and order. Yeah, and it is this meaning which we are concerned. Various sources, however, express this meaning differently, each adding some clarifying and interpretive detail. For example, Noah Webster's basic definition in his 1806 dictionary read, disorderly behavior, tumult. Webster's New World Dictionary offers an extended definition, quote, a wild, violent public disturbance or disturbance of the peace by a number of persons assembled together, unquote. The standard acceptance definition in American common law has remained unchanged since September 12, 1849, when it was stated by Judge Charles P. Daley in the New York City Court of General Sessions. He was presiding over the trial of 10 persons charged with riot or conspiracy to riot during the Astor Place riot. In his charge to the jury, Judge Daley first defined unlawful assembly, saying any tumultuous assemblies of three or more persons brought together for no legal or constitutional object, deporting themselves in such a manner as to endanger the public peace and excite terror and alarm in rational and firm-minded persons is unlawful. Well, I was arrested for unlawful assembly, and most of those things didn't even apply. So it depends on who's got the nightstick. Then he added, following to complete the definition of a riot, and whenever three or more persons in a tumultuous manner use force or violence in the execution of any design wherein the law does not allow the use of force, they're guilty of riot. Well, how many times is the law going to give you the excuse to use violence in public? It's never going to happen. Infanta, whatever they call themselves, dirty Bolsheviks. This legal definition then includes all the elements which make a riot. Three or more persons, a gathering for the purpose of enforcing a demand or expressing a protest instead of using due process of law. That means go to the Jew, due process of law. Ah, the use of violence and endangered the public peace through terror. Terror, there's that terror. The three or more, which is actuality, is usually a much larger group, may have come together for the specific purpose of expressing their feelings with no thought of violence or disorder. But when violence is triggered by an inflammatory speech or by a show of opposition and force, most often the police and the peaceful assemblies becomes a riot, man. A composite definition of a mob might be the disorderly crowd after its members have lost their sense of individual responsibility and their respect for law. Gotta respect that law and order. I always like get a kick out of when we're a country of laws, not men. I say bullshit to that. We're a country of men, then law. Any crowd or throng can be changed into a mob by agitators. Yeah. Hotheads, rowdies, riffraff, criminals, and the ever-present... Oh, how about government informants and government provocateurs? The ever-present hangers-on who are always ready to join in any disorder sometimes seize the initiative and others blindly follow their lead. Well, of course. Goyim goyim. A simple and useful distinction between a crowd, a mob, and a riot is given by Martin Oppenheimer. Oh, yeah, another good Jew going to tell us. And George Lakey in A Manual for Direct Action in 1965 publication in determining that tactics should be used to control demonstrations. The police, according to the authors, need look only to the behavior of the demonstrators. Quote, is this a crowd, a mob, or a riot? A crowd is just a large group of people. A crowd in motion, usually because of a leader, an incident, the appearance of a hated individual or a symbol, is a mob. A riot is a disturbance by three or more persons who want to overcome opposition to their action by lawful or unlawful means. The simplest type of crowd in our society is made up of the spectators at a sports event. Most sports fans have already picked a favorite, whether an individual or a team. If a decision is considered unfair by enough people, the crowd may become ugly and a disturbance take place, which may turn into a full-scale riot when the crowd becomes unreasoning mob. For example, in what Newsweek called the world's worst sporting disaster, at least 318 men and women and children were killed and 500 injured in a riot at a Peru-Argentina Olympic soccer elimination match at Lima's National Stadium on May the 24th, 1964. And I remember that one. Boy, that was a bloody mess. Was Argentina led 1-0, and 2 minutes left into play, the referee nullified a Peruvian goal because of a foul. Immediately, everything that could be pulled loose in the stadium, cushions, bottles, even shoes, rained down on the field. Two angered fans then leaped into the field and started punching the referee, who suspended the game. Many persons in the crowd of 45,000 rushed into the playing field in spite of tear gas bombs fired by the security police. The fury of the mob in the upper stands meanwhile turned to blind panic as thousands attempted to flee the stadium through the nearest exit gates, but they were locked. Oh, that's convenient. And before they were broken open, hundreds of people were killed or injured by being crushed or trampled in a stampede in a tunnel leading to the gates. Other parts of the mob broke down a wire fence and poured from the stadium field, smashed shop windows and setting fire to a dozen cars, a bus, three buildings nearby. Gangs of rowdies joined in the melee that weren't even at the game. Gustave Le Bon in The Crowd, which is one of my favorite books. If you haven't read The Crowd, you need to understand The Crowd if you're going to understand propaganda and other things. Based on his observations of the French Revolution, which is a classic example of crowd behavior, mob action formed the various crises in this upheaval of a people from 1789 to 1792. The storming of the Bastille, the March on Versailles, and the forcible removal of the royal family and the assembly to Paris, and the storming of the Tuileries palaces and massacre of the Swiss guards who were protecting Queen Marie Antoinette. In his study published 70 years ago, Le Bon first attempted to explain what happened when an ordinary peace-loving individual finds himself in a crowd bent on mischief. Quote, when the crowd changes into a mob, he wrote, its individual members lose their identity and merge into a cruel, primitive body which has lost civilized restraints and suddenly has no respect for those law enforcement agencies that resist it, unquote. Le Bon's observation continued, quote, an isolated individual knows well enough that alone he cannot loot a shop or set fire to a building, usually, and should he attempt to do so, he will easily and readily resist the temptation. As a part of the mob, however, he becomes conscious of the power he shares with others, and it's sufficient to suggest ideas of pillage, murder, or violence for him to yield immediately to temptation. Well, the Negroes do that real well. Modern psychologists go a step farther. They contend the mob action hypnotizes the individual, that he never stops to consider the consequences, but merely wants to give in to the urge to do what others are doing and to get into the act, and also to get away with it. Subconsciously, the individual in the mob is able to release his suppressed desires by doing the things he has always wanted to do but has not dared to do alone. That really fits the Negroes. The appearance of a hated individual or symbol can completely transform a restless crowd into a mob. For, you know, like a Confederate flag or a swastika. For example, the display of dismembered corpses and limbs triggered an anti-dissection riot in New York City. The turning of the drums containing the names of those eligible for the Union Army draft and the offices of the Provost Marshal started the draft riots. The appearance of the Pinkerton strikebreakers aboard barges on the Monongahela River in front of the Homestead Steel Mill brought on fatal violence. The initial act of violence by crowd members often releases tensions and results in further acts of ever-increasing ferocity. Sometimes police action so enrages or antagonizes a crowd that its members resort to unprecedented violence. Similarly, indecision and ineffective police control action encourages mob violence, like in Charlottesville when the cops just left. Jeez. As soon as a crowd realizes that it is stronger than the forces of law and order, the crowd, now a mob, begins to glory in its power and lose all traces of restraint, leading to ever bolder actions. Many full-scale riots have been prolonged because the hesitancy of local authorities to summon the aid of outside law enforcement agencies, state or federal. The Pullman strike and the Los Angeles Watts riots were examples. Psychologists and social scientists interested in crowd behavior point out that most major riots take place during the summer months, particularly during heat waves. Fair weather permits people to congregate and discuss their grievances endlessly. The stifling high humidity undoubtedly serves to fray the nerves of frustrated and angry people. Old and long-festering bitternesses and resentments finally erupt into violence. Six of the riots forming chapters in this book occurred in the month of July. The Negro riots during the summers of 64 and 65 are more recent examples. Quote, hate and heat, unquote, are among the valid causes of these insurrections. During its growth, our American democracy, quite naturally experienced both local and nationwide eruptions. The riots described in this book have been selected to represent the varied types of emotions, prejudices, grievances, frustrations, and problems of living which have led to violence at various times and in different geographical areas. Some may be familiar, others will be new to the reader. That's the end of the opening of that book. Now here's a juicy riot. The anti-Chinese riot, Los Angeles, October 24, 1871. Following the gold discoveries of 1848 in California because of the shortage of labor in the boom period, the Chinese were welcomed on the Pacific coast, particularly in the house, as house servants, cooks, gardeners, and laundrymen. Sounds like the wetback. Then, because Chinese native labor was cheap, six companies under contract imported shiploads of indentured coolies, paying for their passage and assigning them on arrival to mining or railroad companies. This influx formed the basis of an ever-growing racial prejudice because their presence reduced the wages of all laborers, including whites, while decreasing the profits of the owners. Public resentment of the Chinese in California began in the mid-1860s when the Pacific Coast residents began openly to express fear of the Orientals, characterizing them as the Chinese menace. In 1870, the actual number of Chinese in the United States was only 62,000, since more than half of the imported coolies had by then returned to their homeland. The Burlingame Treaty with China in 1868 confirmed the right of the Chinese to expatriate themselves without the necessity of becoming American citizens. In 1871, Los Angeles, the City of Angels, was a small rambling town of only 6,000 people. The buildings of wood and adobe were reminders of the days of the Spaniards, and the streets bore Spanish names. A section of downtown near Calle Principal, Main Street, formed the segregated area where most of the Chinese and Mexicans lived peacefully together. This area near the plaza, the cathedral, and the present-day Olivera Street, bordering on the Calle de los Negros, locally translated as Negro or Black Alley, which was the center of local underworld and its attendant gambling, drinking, roistering, and crime. I've been there a lot of times, Olivera Street. Interestingly enough, one of the main and first L.A. Masonic headquarters is in that same block, the same area. And when I went in there and into that building, they had all the pictures of the past masters of the Masons of that lodge, and I would say at least one-third were Jews, maybe more. The small Chinese community lived mainly in the Coronel block, an L-shaped building with a long raised porch on all sides, including interior corral. The apartments were almost all connected by doors. Following the customs of their native land, the Chinese of the town formed association and companies called Tongs. By the way, if you ever get a chance to see an old black and white movie with Edward G. Robinson in it called The Hatchet Man, you should see it. It's brutal. They used to have the guys that ran the Tong mobs. If somebody gave him trouble, they'd send out a guy with a hatchet, and he was expert at throwing the hatchet, and he'd get you right in the back with a hatchet. Fun was had by all. On Friday evening, October 20th, a civil ceremony of marriage, very unusual at the time, was performed by a justice of the peace for a young man, Al A. Choi, of the Nin Young group, and his bride, who belonged to and was literally owned by the rival Hong Chau Company. The purpose of the civil ceremony was apparently to avoid payment for the bride. Since female ownership was then an accepted rule, Tong warfare resulted. 4 days later, on Tuesday, October 24th, The first skirmish between the members of the Nin Young and the Hong Chau companies took place in Negro Alley, when two members exchanged pistol shots, without injuries, however. When both were arrested and booked for attempted murder, a Nin Young merchant, Sam Yon, bailed out Ah Choi, his clansman, with $6,000 in gold which he claimed to have in his store. When a police officer corroborated this story by actually seeing the cachet, Ah Choi was set free. The fact that a Chinese held such wealth on his premises was not overlooked by the topic of conversation in bar rooms and bordellos, and was to play a role in the looting, which was part of the massacre later in the day. At that time, Los Angeles police force numbered 6 men. The chief marshal, Francis Baker, feeling that the fighting was not over, assigned mounted officer Jesus Bildarain to patrol the area just as Ah Choi returned. All was apparently peaceful, but no sooner had he finished his rounds than shots rang out from Negro Alley. The Tongs were again settling their differences, and this time the bridegroom, Ah Choi, had received a wound which was to prove fatal 3 days later. Officer Bildarain asked an armed bystander to help him catch the fleeing Chinese, but they were fired upon from inside the Cornell block. Bildarain entered the house but was soon staggering out without his pistol, and with a gunshot wound in his shoulder, he blew a long blast on his police whistle. A rancher named Robert Thompson and his fellow policemen appeared and were soon pouring pistol shots into the houses in the block. Since these were not returned, Thompson feared yet foolhardily. Foolhardily approached the door. He was met by a barrage of shots from inside the house and staggered backward with a bullet in his chest, dying an hour later. At that moment, Marshal Baker arrived and deputized guards from the crowd that had assembled. He then ordered them to surround the entire block and shoot any Chinese who might try to escape. Some of them went to the corral in the back of the block and were greeted by gunfire from fleeing Chinese. A group of men had meanwhile seized the Wong Tuck, an armed resident of a house across from Colonel Block, and were obviously planning to lynch him when a police officer released him and permitted him to return to his house amid shots fired by members of the crowd. No further efforts were made to locate those who had shot Bildarain and Thompson, but the news had spread quickly, attracting a crowd which grew more restive by the minute. When Robert Thompson died in a drugstore 2 blocks away at approximately 6 o'clock, less than 2 hours later he had been shot, and the news transformed the uneasy crowd in Negro Alley into an unreasoning mob. Maybe they were more reasoning than you think. White people were being killed. The story was elaborated upon elsewhere throughout the town, in this case the usual false report that often triggers a riot, to the effect that the Chinese were killing whites wholesale. Well, they weren't killing whites wholesale, but they were killing whites. The head of the town's single volunteer fire company, organized a month before, arrived at the scene and was prevailed upon to let the fire hose he used in an attempt to flush out the entrapped Chinese. The Chicago fire had occurred only 2 weeks before, he later said in the justifications of his action, and he felt that it would be wise to be prepared should anyone in the mob decide to fire the buildings in which the Chinese were pinned. But this attempt to force them out proved a failure and was abandoned. The death of Thompson had fired the crowd to fever pitch, and its anger needed a target. The once captured and once released Wong Tuck at this moment made another try to get away from his house, this time armed with a hatchet. Immediately on his appearance, he was seized but released to 2 peace officers who started to walk with him to the jail 4 blocks away. The eager crowd churned around them, shouting for Tuck's life. The officers were attacked, and the long tuck was taken by the mob. A rope appeared as if by magic, and within minutes the unlucky Chinese was dangling from the gate of a Tomlinson corral, a lumberyard nearby. While most of the crowd returned to the alley, a few lingered to amuse themselves by banging the dead man's head back and forth against one of the gate's uprights until it was a bloody pulp mass. By now the crowd in Negro Alley had greatly increased, a mixture of merely curious, peaceful citizens and the more numerous trigger-happy riffraff who always gather and assume command when crowds show signs of resorting to violence. This element was composed of scores of ruffians, thieves, gamblers, lone wolves, and thugs and idlers who found that the lax local law enforcement to their taste. In a common pattern of riots, such a restless crowd responds to the harangues of the self-appointed leader. And now a fiery-tongued orator made an inflammatory anti-Chinese speech. When a police officer was bold enough to attempt to silence him, the crowd became threatening, and tirades continued. The Colonel Block was still under the strong guard of citizen deputies. Concerted mob action began in the darkness shortly after 9 o'clock. Since the earlier fire hose tactic had been unsuccessful, another maneuver was tried. Some men climbed up on the flat roof of the Colonel Block and with pickaxes chopped holes through it and then poured gunfire into the apartments below. The result was immediate. Two Chinese ran into the street, meeting the fatal gunfire of the crowd. The crowd's score was now 3 dead, and the bodies of 2 victims were strung up from a porch. Since continuing gunfire through the roof failed to flesh out more victims, some of the restless crowd devised other methods. Quote, "Get the chinks out," unquote, shouted those that were waiting. Some of the hoodlums found a large rock that had fallen off a wagon earlier in the day and used it as a battering ram to break down the doors, but they were afraid to follow up this action by entering. The Chinese inside didn't make an either move nor a sound. Quote, "Burn the chinks," unquote, now became the cry. An ingenious inventor produced a kind of fireball and threw it through the opening made by the rock. A police officer ordered him to retrieve it, and when he flatly refused to enter alone, went inside with him. They soon threw the fireball out into the middle of Negro Alley, where for a long time it gave light for the climatic events of the riot. Since the two came out without incidents, the crowd assumed that it was now safe to enter the building, and they eagerly poured into the doorways, finding dozens of men and women attempting to hide in their apartments. 2 or 3 already killed by gunfire through the roof were thrown out into the streets, where their bodies were beaten and kicked before being dragged off to be hanged. Rings were torn from their fingers, and in several instances a ring proved too tight, a finger was chopped off. Of the Chinese found alive, some were dragged along the street to various hanging places. A large number of citizens and deputy guards, unnoticed in the confusion, were meanwhile able to rescue many men, women, and children and take them to safety of the jail. A policeman, the one who had been shown the cache of gold in Sam Yun's store, figured that the time was favorable for a bit of private enterprise and began to make his way to the premises. En route, he seized several Chinese and turned them over to the mob, directing the custodians to take them to safety of the jail. Instead, they were doomed to the gallows. One of the victims was shot through the mouth and robbed before being strung up. The porch roof of Goller's Wagon Shop, a block from Negro Alley, became the busiest gallows. The ropes were clotheslines given the crowd by the proprietors of a boarding house. 6 bodies finally swung from the roof truss. At the same time, other rioters were hanging Chinese from the sides of the two prairie schooners that were standing nearby. Still others from the cross beams of a gate of the Tomlinson Corral where Wong Tuck had been first to be hanged. The gate was guarded by men with loaded rifles and pistols aimed at the crowd in case some citizens should attempt to interfere. Five victims, including a 14-year-old boy, were hanged simultaneously. The five ropes pulled by honored ruffians selected from the mob. All those hanged had previously been shot, stabbed, or beaten, and blood, rare in their ordinary hangings, was spattered everywhere. While these four hanging parties were venting their fury on their captives, scores of mob members were systematically pillaging and vacated quarters, seizing anything of value available. The looting continued throughout the night without interference. No police officer or citizen was willing to risk his life by intervening. The situation was completely without remedy, and the law enforcement officers failed even to summon the federal troops stationed at Drum Barracks in Wilmington, only 20 miles away by railroad. Meanwhile, law-abiding citizens could only hide their Chinese servants and cooks from the possible rage of the lawless mob. By 11 o'clock on the evening of October 24, 1871, the mob had completed its acts of vengeance, and 18 mutilated bodies were swaying at rope's ends, six at the wagon shop, five at the Tomlinson Corral, four at the Coronel Block, and three from the freight prairie schooners. The bodies of the first victim, Wong Tuck, had been cut down at the Tomlinson Corral and dragged to a cemetery where Al Choi, the wounded bridegroom, died 3 days later. The total became 20, though some writers raised the total to 22 or 23. The number shot but subsequently hanged was never revealed, for a veil of discreet silence was drawn over printed reports and later trial testimony. The lack of information was undoubtedly due to the fact that the mob, at its largest numbering, about 600, a tenth of the population, included many prominent citizens who succumbed to their anti-Chinese prejudices under the stimulus of riotous crowd. Some of these became leaders of the city's later development. In addition to the slaughter, the Chinese quarter were looted of more than $30,000 in money and personal property. This included the $6,000 in gold hidden in Sam Juan's store. When he sued the town of Los Angeles for his loss on the basis of negligence of the public protective forces, the all-white jury made no award. Sam Juan, they stated, had failed to take reasonable diligence by notifying the sheriff or mayor that a riot was in the making on that October afternoon. A special grand jury was convened a week later. The number of indictments for murder never made public was variously reported as 30, 39, and 150. Only 10 participants were brought to trial on March 17, 1872, and they were charged with the murder of Dr. Chin Lee Tong, one of the victims. After abundant private testimony, eight were pronounced guilty and two not guilty. They were given sentences varying from 2 to 6 years each to be served at San Quentin State Prison. Scores of those indicted, however, were never brought to trial. Everyone agreed unanimously that the regrettable incident should be forgotten. A little more than a year later, the California Supreme Court reversed the Los Angeles jury's verdict. The indictment in this case is fatally defective, and it fails to allege that Chin Lee Tong was murdered. The statement read, quote, "It's alleged that the defendants did stand by, aid, abet, assist, advise, counsel, and encourage one John Doe and one Richard Roe to felonious, unlawful, willfully, deliberately, premeditatedly, and of malice aforethought to kill and murder Chin Lee Tong," unquote. The astounding legal opinion continued, quote, admitting that the defendants did all these things, still it does not follow by necessary legal conclusions that, after all, any person was actually murdered, unquote. The prison doors were opened, and all could breathe a sigh of relief, for justice had been done. The defendants were never reindicted. That's back when white people ran things. The China riot became a, or at least the right kind of white ran things. The China riot became a matter of history, but the Chinese problem remained, and a blind racism which punished the entire Chinese community of Los Angeles for the murder of a single white man persisted. Back then, you just don't kill white men if you're non-white. San Francisco's Sandlot riots in 1877 were triggered when Dennis Kearney, one of my great heroes, who started the Working Man's Party in California and went after the rich bastards that were bringing the Chinese in. That's another story. Harangued unemployed workmen with the cry of "the Chinese must go," because imported coolies were working for the Central Pacific Railroad for 65 cents a day. The property of many Chinese was sacked and burned. Other major anti-Chinese riots occurred in Denver in 1880 and in Rock Springs, Wyoming mining camp in 1885. The hue and cry against Orientals, including also the Japanese, resulted in a reenactment of the Exclusionary Act of 1882 and 1892, applying particularly to the importation of laborers and making Chinese ineligible for citizenship, a voiding of the 1868 Burlington Treaty. The Immigration Act of 1924, you see, this is when the Klan was riding high. They had a lot of political power. Prohibited the entrance of all Asiatic laborers. So if you say the Klan didn't do any good in the 20s, you're wrong. They did some really important work. All these discriminatory laws were repealed by the U.S. Congress in 1943. And since the Chinese immigration has been regulated under a quota system. Now they're coming in here like mad. You can't believe it. Last I heard, over a third of Vancouver, Canada, was Chinese. Now they're moving south. As the years have passed, anti-Chinese prejudice has disappeared. I don't think so that much. In the cities of large Chinese populations living together according to their preferences in Chinatowns, in other words, segregation, separation, which works. Police officials report the rate of crime in those areas to be low and criminal acts particularly non-existent. I don't believe that because the Chinese triads run Chinatown. They run all the drugs, everything, prostitution, gambling. They're more powerful than the Chicago mob used to be. Their sense of family closeness and veneration of the elders is enviable, and their fear of talking to anybody. They have earned the respect of the communities where they live, or fear of their leaders, I'll put it that way. And that's the end of my reading of the Chinese riots of the 1800s. How do you like that? To get your juices going for the weekend, have a good time, be careful, and don't join in any riots. Riots don't pay off. If you want to get other people to riot, fine, but stay out of riots yourself. At least if you see a lot of people surging towards the local police station with Molotov cocktails, make sure you step into a doorway a block before you get there.
History, in every century, the court's an act that lives forevermore. We'll recall, as into line we fall, the thing that happened on Hawaii shore. Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we go to meet the foe. Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we did the Alamo. remember how they died for liberty. Let's remember Pearl Harbor and go on to victory.
Let's remember.